Hi everyone, Sebastian here. Before we start the show this week, I just want to take a minute to talk about our new Our Fake History Patreon campaign. So, as many of you know, I produce this podcast entirely independently. So that means the only thing that keeps it going is dedicated supporters like yourself. All of you out there who have donated to the show or buy the extra episodes, you're the thing that makes Our Fake History possible. Well, now there's a new, easy, and really awesome way to support the show, and that's through Patreon.com. Just go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and you can become a monthly supporter of the podcast and get all sorts of cool rewards while you do it. I'm going to talk more about it at the end of the show. So before you do anything else, head to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and check it out. All right, let's get into it. On a hot night in the middle of the Russian summer in 1918, the former Tsar Nicholas II was awoken from his sleep by his family doctor, one Eugene Botkin. Botkin had been with the Romanov family for years. He had nursed all of Nicholas's children through various illnesses, including his son Alexei's devastating attacks of hemophilia. Botkin had even watched with his own eyes as the strange mystic Rasputin had miraculously healed the heir to the throne. The loyal doctor, who had been with the family for so long, now shared their fate as a prisoner of the Bolshevik regime. Botkin told the former Tsar to get dressed, as the royal family was going to be moved yet again to a new safe house. Nicholas was then led by armed guards out of his modest cottage and across the lawn towards a small outbuilding. From there, he was guided down into a dank basement. When he reached the bottom of the stairs, the leader of the guards, one Yakov Yurovsky, read this statement aloud. Quote, Nikolai Alexandrovich, in the view of the fact that your relatives are continuing their attack on Soviet Russia, the Ural Executive Committee has decided to execute you. End quote. The Tsar was apparently completely perplexed by this and stammered, What? What? Yakovsky just stoically repeated the order to be sure that Nicholas fully understood what was going on. Then the guards opened fire, killing the last Tsar of the Romanov dynasty, the house who had ruled Russia for over 300 years. The execution had come just over a year after the Tsar had formally abdicated his throne in hopes that a new representative government might bring some stability to his country. Instead, the country had been rocked by increasing violence, a second revolution, and now a bloody civil war. This was a sad end of a life that had only ever been brightened by one thing: the Tsar's family. But where was that family in this dark moment? Had they shared the Tsar's gruesome fate in the basement, or had they been spared? Had one, or maybe all of the Tsar's children, escaped execution and made their way to freedom? In the years after the execution, at least 16 different people would come forward claiming to be a Romanov. But how compelling were these claims? And why is it that Anastasia, the youngest of the Romanov princesses, would be the family member who lingered the longest in the popular imagination? Did this precocious teenager really defy the odds and go on to live a quiet life in small-town America? This is Our Fake History. Episode 30. Will the real Anastasia please stand up? Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major and this is the podcast where we look at historical myths and try and determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we round out our look at the doomed Romanov family by exploring the mystery associated with the youngest of the imperial princesses, Anastasia. As it turns out, the last Russian Tsar and his family have been a pretty fruitful topic for this podcast. They almost rival Napoleon when you start telling up the most myths per capita. In a way, this is somewhat ironic, as Tsar Nicholas was kind of a dull person. Honestly, if he'd not been the Tsar during one of the most turbulent periods in Russian history, Nicholas would have just been a doting family man. In a lot of ways, I think he would have had a much better life if he'd just been a suburban dad with like a comfortable middle management job. All this guy wanted to do was leave his work at the office, go to his kids' ballet recitals, horse around in a tin fishing boat on the weekends, and generally have some peace and quiet around the house. Apparently, when Nicholas was under house arrest in the early days of the Russian Revolution, his favorite things to do were tidy up the yard, shovel snow off the walkways, and read Sherlock Holmes stories. I mean, that is some serious dad behavior. When it comes to politics, I get the feeling that if Tsar Nicholas was one of my neighbors, he'd be the kind of guy who dutifully voted for the most conservative candidate in every election, but when pressed, he would admit that he doesn't really follow politics and he really doesn't like talking about it around the dinner table. Now, imagine that guy trying to manage the most complex series of political crises in European history. I mean, you can't help but feel bad for him. The guy was in way over his head, and as a result, it led to some very poor decision-making and left a lot of people dead. That's an important thing to remember before we get too maudlin about the Tsar. His bumbling led to massacres. You see, despite the royal family's yearning for normalcy, their life was anything but normal. Not only was it filled with the pomp of imperial office, but it was also filled with a ton of weirdness. Their family was surrounded by very strange people. When a big part of your regular routine includes faith healing sessions conducted by Rasputin, it's hard to pretend that your life is normal. And therein lies the great fascination with the Romanovs. They are simultaneously the most unusual and yet somehow the most typical family you could ever meet. The other important facet of Romanov mythology has to do with what they represent. You see, they were the last of a dying breed. The Tsars were the last monarchs in Europe to have anything approximating absolute power. While most of the continent had transitioned to a constitutional system of government in the mid-1800s, Russia had clung stubbornly to its autocracy. Nicholas would eventually give some power to an elected parliament known as the Duma, but he never really embraced the idea of a constitutional monarchy. So when the royal family was swept away by the revolution, it was often read as the final death of European monarchy in general. In other words, they were the last of the unicorns. And much like those mythical creatures, monarchs were also popularly believed to have magical powers. They came from a tradition that said that God had specifically chosen their family to rule a country. European monarchs often traced their lineage back to mythical heroes like Aeneas and even Hercules. There was even the belief that a king could heal illness simply by laying his hands on an affected person. So, with that in mind, it's perhaps less of a surprise that the most persistent myth about the Romanovs is that they weren't actually dead. Enough people wanted to believe that they had spotted the last unicorn that eventually people started turning up with horns glued to their foreheads. This brings us to Princess Anastasia, the plucky survivor girl of the Romanov horror film. As any fan of 80s slasher movies can tell you, the one person who manages to escape the wrath of the psycho killer is the lone white teenage girl who knew better than to fool around with the boys up at the abandoned cabin. Interestingly enough, Anastasia perfectly fits in with this trope. She had just turned 17 years old when her family was killed by the Bolsheviks, and her alleged escape from the clutches of the assassins was just as incredible as a young Jamie Lee Curtis avoiding the knife of an escaped mental patient. But is there anything to the stories of Anastasia's escape? Who was this Russian princess, and how did she become the most well-known of the Romanov children? Well, let's take a closer look. Anastasia Romanoff was born in June of 1901. She was the fourth daughter born to Tsar Nicholas II and Tsarina Alexandra, which at the time was a bit of a disappointment. You see, the imperial couple were desperate for a male heir. Even in 1901, the regime was shaky. The couple's inability to have a son only fueled the resolve of those who would be happy to see the monarchy retired. Up to this point, as much as Nicholas had hoped for a male heir, he had always reacted with delight when he discovered he had a new daughter. When his oldest daughter, Olga, had been born, a story circulated in the press that the Tsar had proudly remarked to his chamberlain, quote, "I am glad that our child is a girl. Had it been a boy, he would have belonged to the people. Being a girl, she belongs to us," end quote. But after Olga came Tatiana, and then Maria. And now, after a fourth pregnancy, the royal couple found themselves with yet another daughter. Apparently, Nicholas II chose to take a very long, reflective walk before deciding to go visit his new child and her mother. But despite these early misgivings, the royal family very quickly became enamored with their youngest daughter, and they were soon doting on her in the same way they did with all of their children. The Tsar's crushing disappointment was also abated when Alexandra gave birth to Prince Alexei in 1904. In the meantime, Anastasia grew into a very precocious and mischievous child. In a household full of people who were either sick or depressed, Anastasia stood out as a prankster. She was actually nicknamed the Imp. The son of the family physician, Eugene Botkin, once remarked that, quote, "She undoubtedly held the record for punishable deeds in her family, for in naughtiness she was a true genius," end quote. One of Anastasia's distant cousins was even more scathing in her appraisal of the little princess, noting that she was, quote, "nasty to the point of being evil," end quote. She was known to do things like hide under her bed, climb trees and refuse to come down, and hide stones inside of snowballs in hopes of injuring her playmates. She was also known to have a very sarcastic sense of humor that sometimes annoyed the adults in her life. In short, she was a little stinker. Now, as Anastasia grew, her pranks became less mischievous, but she never seemed to lose her sense of humor. Author Helen Rappaport described her as the Romanovs' court jester, who managed to keep the family's spirits up even during the darkest days of their house arrest at the hands of the Russian revolutionaries. In her lifetime, the most salacious rumor to circulate about Anastasia has to do with our old friend Grigory Rasputin. As you might remember from the last episode, the Russian press had openly speculated that the mystic had an indecent sexual relationship with Anastasia and the other princesses. This was after tender letters from the girls were stolen from Rasputin and leaked to the papers. Pornographic comic strips even circulated, illustrating the naughtier parts of the story. But as I mentioned last week, there was nothing in these letters that ever suggested that anything inappropriate had taken place between the princesses and Rasputin. It was true that for a time he had been allowed to visit the girls in their rooms, and one servant had been horrified to learn that Rasputin had seen the girls in their long dressing gowns. But beyond that, there seems to have been nothing untoward going on. In fact, the girls seemed to really love Rasputin and honored him like a family member. They were noticeably rattled by his murder in 1916, and they grieved openly. Apparently, when Rasputin's body was exhumed, he was found wearing a small religious icon that had been signed by Anastasia, Maria, Tatiana, Olga, and Tsarina Alexandra. But beyond Anastasia's affiliation with Rasputin, she was rarely thought of by the Russian press at the time. The older sisters, who were of marriageable age, were far more interesting, as the tabloids could gleefully report on rumors of proposed marriages. One of the most popular was that Olga had been secretly betrothed to Edward, the Prince of Wales. And that's the same Edward who would go on to abdicate the throne in order to marry the American divorcee, Wallace Simpson. Being that she was the youngest daughter, Anastasia was generally considered the least important member of the royal family. So, how is it that Anastasia is the Romanov who has been remembered? I mean, honestly, how many of you out there could have named one of the other Romanov sisters before you started listening to this podcast? Okay, I know there's a few of you, but I think you see my point. Interestingly enough, the reason that Anastasia is remembered has very little to do with her life and has everything to do with her death, or lack thereof. Now, the end of the Romanov dynasty is deeply wrapped up in the various ins and outs of the Russian Revolution. We don't really have the space to get into all of that in this humble podcast, but you need to understand a few key things. Often, the Russian Revolution is understood simply as a communist revolution, but the truth, as you might expect, is far more complex. The Russian Revolution can be more accurately understood if you break it into three stages. These stages are commonly called the February Revolution, the October Revolution, and the Civil War. Now, the dating on all of this gets complicated because the Russians were using the less accurate Julian calendar at the time, but we're not going to worry ourselves with that too much. We're just going to stick with those categories. So the February Revolution was characterized by mass demonstrations in Russia's major cities against the war, the lack of food, and the general incompetence of the Tsar. This led Nicholas II to finally cave to the pressure and formally abdicate the throne. The governance of Russia was taken over by the Duma, led by Prime Minister Alexander Kerensky. This became known as the Provisional Government. Now, compared to where the revolution would eventually go, the provisional government was actually quite moderate. They allowed the former emperor to keep his servants and his entourage, and they kept the royal family under a rather comfortable house arrest in the Alexander Palace in Tsarskoye Selo. In those early days, the assassination of the Tsar didn't even seem to be part of the discussion. It was actually quite scandalous even to suggest it. But by August of 1917, the provisional government was losing control of the country, and violence had again erupted in the streets of Russia's cities. As a result, the family was moved eastward to the Siberian town of Tobolsk, where they were quartered in a house that formerly served as the governor's mansion in the province. Now, despite the relatively comfortable accommodations, this was a decidedly miserable time for the family. Alexei once again suffered from painful bouts of hemophilia, and each of the girls took their turn dealing with some nearly fatal illness. At one point, one of the girls' health got so bad that she started to lose her hair. So, the rest of the sisters dutifully shaved their heads out of solidarity. For the girls, it was an odd point of pride. But for their deteriorating mother, it was deeply depressing, as she thought it made her children look like the condemned. Things changed even more drastically after the October Revolution that brought the Bolsheviks to power. Vladimir Lenin's government was decidedly less interested in paying for the former royals to keep servants and live in comfort. Their rations were reduced, their servants were let go, and the guards became noticeably less friendly. This culminated in the family being moved once again, this time to the far more meager accommodations in the town of Yekaterinburg. And this is where things start to get murky. The coup that brought Lenin and the Bolsheviks to power also sparked a civil war. This was between the communists, who became known as the Reds, and a coalition of monarchists, centrists, and others who opposed Lenin's regime, who became known as the Whites. As you might imagine, there was nothing the Whites wanted to do more than rescue the Tsar. Once Lenin seized control of Russia, the former royal family had become his personal responsibility. He monitored them quite closely, and anything that happened to them was always done because of explicit orders from Vladimir Lenin. Everything, that is, except the execution. You see, in the summer of 1918, the Whites looked as though they might be poised to take Yekaterinburg and liberate the royal family. Now, most historians seem to think that Lenin was wary of having his prized hostages captured, and so he ordered their execution. This theory is backed up by the diary of the famous Bolshevik Leon Trotsky, who notes that he was told in a conversation with another top party member that Lenin had made the final call about the Tsar's execution. Except, the only issue is that there's absolutely no paper trail of this. All historians have are some orders in the local Ural Executive Committee speaking of the liquidation of the Tsar. So either Lenin did not order the execution, and it was just carried out by some overly zealous Bolshevik officers on the ground, or the communist leader purposefully kept his name off of any documents that had to do with the execution. I mean, it's crazy to think that even the most hardline communist revolutionary still did not want history to remember him as the killer of a king. Who knows? Maybe even old Lenin was still a little dazzled by the ancient magic of the monarchy. Either way, to this day, it's still not clear exactly who ordered the death of the royal family. The waters get muddied even further when you consider that the Bolsheviks actively put out misinformation about the assassination. 2 days after the execution, the local Yekaterinburg press reported about the, quote, execution of Nicholas, the bloody crowned murderer, shot without bourgeois formalities in accordance with our new democratic principles, end quote. It was also noted that, quote, the wife and son of Nicholas Romanov have been sent to a safe place, end quote. This story was repeated again in the national press 2 days later. So from the outset, the official story of the Bolsheviks was that Alexandra and Alexei were still alive. And notably, absolutely nothing was said about the four princesses. No one knew if they were alive or if they were dead. Now, this uncertainty immediately bred rumor. Sightings of the princesses started to be reported all around the country. A story soon spread that a group of Red Guards had stopped a train and angrily interrogated the passengers, asking them about the whereabouts of Anastasia Romanov. These rumors grew and eventually hardened into a fully functional myth. One, maybe all of the Romanov children were still out there. All they needed to do was step forward. In the years following the execution of the Tsar, at least 16 different people would come forward claiming to be one of the Romanov children. There were at least two women who claimed to be the Grand Duchess Tatiana. In the 1993 book, The Romanov Conspiracies, Michael Osselshaw tried to lend some credence to the claim that a woman named Larissa Tudor had actually been the second oldest Romanov. His contention was that she had been spirited away from Russia by the British in the days leading up to the Tsar's execution. Larissa would eventually marry an English military officer named Owen Tudor, and upon her untimely death at the age of 28, she left him an eyebrow-raising fortune. This led many to speculate that she had in fact been one of the Romanovs, and many pointed to her striking resemblance of Tatiana. Now, Larissa Tudor's identity was never actually verified, and we should probably take any book called The Romanov Conspiracies with a healthy grain of salt. Now, there was also a woman named Marga Boods, who claimed that she was in fact the Princess Olga, the oldest of the Romanov siblings. Her story was that she had been saved by a Cossack guard during the execution. The guard had knocked her unconscious and told the commanding officer that she was dead. The young officer then replaced her body with that of a local girl and helped smuggle Olga to the Pacific coastal city of Vladivostok. There, she was met by an elite German commando who helped her get back to Germany by way of China. Now, the interesting thing about Marga Boots was that she actually managed to convince a number of high society Europeans of her story. She even visited the deposed German Kaiser Wilhelm II in exile, and convinced him that she was in fact Princess Olga. Apparently, the old Kaiser actually provided for her financially for the rest of his life. She also managed to convince a number of other German aristocrats and even Pope Pius XII that she was the real Olga. In this case, being an imposter really seemed to pay, as many of these rich benefactors were only too happy to keep the alleged former princess living in style. But despite Marga's apparent success in convincing the world that she was Olga Romanov, her story is completely overshadowed by the most famous Romanov imposter, a woman who is known to history as Anna Anderson, or if you believe her, Princess Anastasia. Now, this is a truly weird story, so buckle up. In February of 1920, a woman who refused to identify herself was admitted to a mental hospital in Dahldorf, Germany. She had been rescued by a police sergeant after she had tried to take her own life by jumping from a bridge in Berlin. She was admitted to the hospital under the mysterious name of Miss Unknown, and she spoke German with what seemed like a Russian accent. Now, cut ahead 2 years, when another psychiatric patient at Dahldorf, a woman named Clara Putart, starts saying that Miss Unknown bears a striking resemblance to Tatiana Romanov. Now, Putart seemed to be a rather well-connected woman, and when she was discharged, she started spreading the story amongst her high society friends that she had met a Romanov princess while in the hospital. This caught the ear of a former Russian military officer living in Germany named Nicholas von Schwab. The curious Schwab went and visited the woman at the mental hospital, and he too came away convinced that it was Tatiana. As the word amongst the Russian emigre crowd began to spread, more and more exiled Russians started visiting the woman to see if she was in fact Tatiana. Eventually, one of the Tsarina's former ladies-in-waiting who had escaped Russia, a woman who would have known the princesses quite well, came to visit the woman at Dahldorf. She was completely unconvinced and commented that the Dahldorf patient was, quote, far too short to be Tatiana. Now, that should have been enough to kill the story right there. But instead, Clara Putart completely backpedaled and said, oh, I never said she was Tatiana. Actually, she looks more like Anastasia. Yeah, that's the ticket, Anastasia. And that alter ego is what would stick. From then on, this unidentified woman would insist that she was the Princess Anastasia. After that point, the Dahldorf patient started going by the alias Anna Tchaikovsky, the Anna being a coy reference to her, quote, real name, Anastasia. So, let's just take a minute here and reflect on the fact that this entire thing got started because one mental patient convinced another mental patient that they were a Russian princess. And then halfway through their little deception, they changed the princess that she was supposed to be. Guys, this is bonkers. Even more amazing is the amount of well-respected people who took seriously the claims of the newly dubbed Anna Tchaikovsky. Soon, former Russian nobles were providing for Anna financially, and even putting her up in their expensive homes. She was visited by dozens of aristocrats and many former members of the Tsar's household. Now, it's important to note that nearly all of the people who had actually known Anastasia as a child and met Anna Tchaikovsky thought that she looked nothing like the princess. They were also perplexed by the fact that she didn't even speak Russian. Now, one of the few people to actually corroborate Anna's claims was the daughter of Dr. Botkin. That was the Tsar's physician that we mentioned at the top of the episode. Now, she had actually known Anastasia as a child and thought that Anna Tchaikovsky bore some resemblance to the princess. But even she had to admit that, quote, her attitude is childlike, and altogether she cannot be reckoned with as a responsible adult, but must be led and directed like a child. She has not only forgotten languages, but has in general lost the power of accurate narration. Even the simplest stories she tells incoherently and incorrectly. They are really only words strung together in impossibly ungrammatical German. Her defect is obviously in her memory and eyesight, end quote. So basically, anyone who came to visit what they thought was an elegant Russian princess instead got a confused woman with an obvious mental health issue. But in a weird way, this actually helped her case. Her inability to answer questions about her childhood could be shrugged off as the result of her mental illness. I mean, who's to say that Princess Anastasia hadn't just gone crazy? Eventually, Anna Tchaikovsky was taken in by Anastasia's real uncle, the Grand Duke of Hesse, and was put up in the beautiful Castle Sion. Now, while she was staying there, another German aristocrat, worried that the Duke was being had by an imposter, had a private investigator look into Anna Tchaikovsky. It didn't take the private eye long to discover that this woman was actually a Polish factory worker by the name of Franciszka Szanskowska. Apparently, her husband had died in World War I, and after a freak accident where a grenade went off in her factory, she badly hurt her head. Franciszka was then declared legally insane. The private eye even managed to find one of Franciszka's brothers, a man named Felix. Now, his plan was to have the brother come to Castle Sion, positively identify the fake Anastasia as a Polish factory worker, and end the charade once and for all. But when Felix got to the castle, he completely waffled. He admitted that Anna certainly looked like his sister, but he wasn't really 100% sure. And so the mystery lived on. Later in life, Felix Szanskowska would admit that he knew that Anna Tchaikovsky was his sister. He completely recognized her. But he didn't want to mess up the sweet hustle that she seemed to have going here. I mean, she was literally living in a castle. Felix knew that her life there would be infinitely better than what his poor family could provide for her. So he smudged the truth a little bit for the sake of his sister. While living at Castle Sion, Anna was even visited by her old pal Felix Yusupov, the upper-crust aristocrat who killed Grigory Rasputin. Yusupov had this to say about Miss Tchaikovsky. Quote, "I claim categorically that she is not Anastasia, but just an adventuress, a sick hysteric, and a frightful play actress. I simply cannot understand how anyone can be in doubt of this. If you had seen her, I am convinced that you would recoil in horror at the thought that this frightful creature could be a daughter of our Tsar." End quote. So, clearly Yusupov was not impressed. But, as we discussed last time, Yusupov is not necessarily our most reliable source. But I think in this case, I gotta side with the old scallywag. So, even though Anna was denounced by a number of Russian aristocrats who had actually met Anastasia as a child, she always managed to attract a small group of true believers. Eventually, Anna moved to the United States, where she started going by the name of Anna Anderson. In America, Anna got involved with Gleb Botkin. That was the son of Dr. Eugene Botkin. Gleb got her involved in a number of harebrained schemes to get a hold of the lost Romanov fortune. Now, none of these ever worked, and eventually Anna settled into a life as a well-loved local eccentric in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every few years, she would find herself in the news again, and the story of how Princess Anastasia survived the Bolshevik bullets would again get pumped back into the media. So, oddly enough, the main reason why Anastasia became the best-known Romanov was because she had the best-known imposter. Anna Anderson kept Anastasia's name alive and in the nudes for decades after people stopped talking about Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Alexei. This is also partially why fiction writers and filmmakers chose to focus on Anastasia anytime they chose to depict a surviving Romanov. In a strange twist, a mentally disturbed Polish factory worker would help secure the legacy of an imperial princess. Thank you. So what really happened on that night in 1918 that brought an end to the life of Tsar Nicholas II? Well, it turns out that all of the Tsar's family were right there with him in that basement. In 1934, the executioner Yakov Yurovsky left a very detailed account of the liquidation of the royal family. In his telling, each of the guards had been assigned the task of killing one of the members of the royal family. That way, fewer bullets would be wasted, and they would be certain that all of them were dead. Yurovsky himself was given the honor of killing the Tsar. But the execution ended up being sloppy. And after the first firing spree that left bullets ricocheting off the walls, all of the children were still alive. One often repeated story is that the girls survived the bullets because they had sewn diamonds and other family jewels into their clothing. The diamond-laced garments basically acted like a high-end bulletproof vest. Now, this is a very cool story, and we do know that the girls had been hiding jewels by sewing them into their clothes. But it's important to note that Yurovsky says nothing about this. Instead, Yurovsky tells us a grim tale of having to bayonet the still-living children. He then disposed of the bodies in the woods, taking care to douse all of the bodies in acid and hide the mass grave as best as he possibly could. It was imperative that the bodies did not fall into the hands of the advancing White Army. And so, the final resting place of the Romanovs remained hidden for the next 70 years. But in 1991, a group of researchers uncovered a mass grave in the forest outside of Yekaterinburg. The remains of five people were found in the grave, four fully grown adults and one teenager. DNA testing would later conclusively prove that these remains did in fact belong to the Romanovs. The size and shape of these remains suggested that they belonged to the Tsar, his wife, Olga, Tatiana, and either Maria or Anastasia. Two sets of remains were mysteriously missing. Those who believed that Anastasia or Alexei had escaped now seem to have been vindicated by science. Their bones were not in the mass grave. Therefore, the Anastasia story still had life. But the story doesn't end there. In 2007, a group of Russian archaeologists, using Yakov Yurovsky's memoirs as a guide, unearthed the remains of two young people in what had once been a bonfire pit. The bones looked as though they belonged to a boy between the ages of 10 and 14, and a girl between the ages of 18 and 23. In other words, it was Alexei and one of his sisters. In 2008, DNA testing would prove exactly that. The remains belonged to the Romanov children. At long last, everyone was accounted for. And so we can now say with certainty that the entire Romanov family was killed that night in 1918. So now that we know conclusively that there were no survivors, all of these Romanov pretenders seem all the more ridiculous. But when it comes to Romanov imposters, I feel less annoyed with the people who carried out the deceptions than I do with the stupid aristocrats who gave these people money. I can understand why someone would pretend to be a Romanov. If you were even the least bit convincing, some German duke might let you live in his castle. But why were these German dukes so easily suckered? Perhaps they just didn't want to believe that the last unicorn was dead. Or perhaps they just wanted to have a pet unicorn of their own that they could show off to their friends. But at the end of the day, there are no unicorns. Only mentally ill Polish factory workers with really awesome brothers. Okay, that's all for this week. Thanks again for listening. But before we go this week, there's some really important announcements to make. First and foremost, Our Fake History now has a Patreon campaign. So for those of you who don't know what Patreon is, it's a service that allows you to pledge monthly donations to artists, musicians, and podcasts that you love. It also allows those artists to get extras and exclusive stuff to the people that have chosen to support them. Now, as I'm sure you guys can imagine, getting out a high-quality show to you every 2 weeks for free takes a lot of effort. And the hope is that the Patreon campaign is a way to just keep this podcast going. With a bit more compensation, I can put more time into these episodes, get out more extra stuff, and hopefully maybe in the future, keep the episodes coming at a faster rate than they currently are. So if you're interested in anything like that, go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory. Think about pledging $1, $3, $5, or more to our campaign and check out all the cool extras that you get at those different levels of support. Thanks again to everyone who supported us up to this point. Those of you who have made donations at the website, those of you who have bought the extra episodes, those of you that have written reviews on iTunes and in other places on the internet, and those of you that just send me nice messages through email or on Twitter, and all of you out there that never speak to me and are just listening and just know the sound of my voice but like it, you too, you the silent majority, I will call you, you're out there too, and I thank you as well. So there you go, just another big heartfelt thanks. As always, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Twitter at ourfakehistory. You can go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/ourfakehistory, and you can check out all the cool stuff we've got posted there. As always, the music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. All the other music that you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming, like when your favorite podcast is playing and the person next to you is talking and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their nifty comparison tool a try and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you need is easy. All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverages you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies all lined up and ready to compare, so it's simple to choose the rate and coverages you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.